Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And well, are you ready for a break from politics and government? I am. If you are too, then you're going to get a real treat today because we're going to look back at a famous TV personality with Iowa roots. Who had a major influence on American culture during an important period in American history. He's Johnny Carson, who is the subject of a new book called Carson the Magnificent. Here with me today to discuss the book is one of the authors. His name is Mike Thomas. He's a former writer for the Chicago Sun-Times and writes now for Chicago Magazine. The other author is the late Bill Zamy, who some of you may be aware of, just an excellent author, wrote numerous books on Hollywood personalities. For example, I read one on Frank Sinatra called The Way You Wear Your Hat. We'll discuss the way this book came about under very unusual circumstances, but I'm very grateful it did. Mike, welcome to Heartland Politics.
It's great to be here, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's just start and tell the story of how this book came together. It was kind of unusual, unfortunate, but it was years in the making. Just share with our listeners how this came about.
Well, Bill had been working on the book since 2005. Shortly after Johnny died is when he signed the contract to do it. And it was based on an Esquire profile he'd done of Johnny in retirement in 2002. I would say Bill actively worked on this book for probably about a dozen years, including his research for the Esquire piece. He found Johnny to be very elusive. You mentioned the Frank Sinatra book. I worked on that with Bill. I was his research assistant for 3 years. So we worked on the Sinatra book, on an Andy Kaufman biography, among other things. But Frank lived his life outwardly. And he was a very emotional guy, wore his heart on his sleeve. And so writing sort of an easy, breezy Life According to Frank book was a bit simpler than doing the same for Johnny. And I think that's initially how Bill thought he might approach Johnny. Johnny is a very insular, introverted, inner living figure. And that stymied Bill all along the way. And then, of course, in 2013, Bill found out he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and everything came to a halt and never really revived. So Bill lasted almost 10 years after that diagnosis. He kept fighting. About probably 3 months after he died, Bill's former editor, John Karp, who was at Random House when he bought the book and is now the CEO of Simon & Schuster, got a hold of me and ultimately asked me if I would like to take a stab at completing this book. And, it was daunting. I didn't know what Bill had collected research-wise. I had never read the manuscript. So I said, John, give me a few weeks. Let me see what he has. Let me read the manuscript, see what kind of work might lay ahead. And I ultimately decided to do it, even though Bill was Bill, legend in his world, and Johnny is a legend in his world. So not an undaunting endeavor, but I'm glad I decided to do it.
Curious, you talk about in the book, it certainly goes into it, how Carson was a very insular person, hard really to get him to open up. He went through 4 marriages had some friends, but I wonder how did Bill get close with Johnny? And I got to go back to the Iowa roots, the shared Midwestern background. Sure. I mean, Johnny Carson was born in Iowa, moved around in southwestern Iowa. Do you think that's part of it? Maybe some way.
That was part of it when they met. I think that shared Midwesternness. Yeah, Johnny was in, I think, four different locations in Iowa before he and his family settled in Norfolk, Nebraska, across the border. Bill played the long game with Johnny. He started pursuing him during Johnny's final year of the Tonight Show, 1991. Bill was at Rolling Stone at the time. He was making a name for himself. And I have a letter because Bill saved everything. And I have a letter on Rolling Stone stationery that Bill wrote to his editor, Bob Wallace, and said, "Bob, I think it's about time we start trying to make inroads with Johnny. He's in his final year of The Tonight Show. Johnny's son had died recently, but it had been a few months. Johnny was starting to heal." And, you know, Bill said, "It's no sense begging for, you know, a ton of FaceTime, but maybe they'll at least let me hang out backstage, you know, during one of the spring shows before his May bow out." And as a result, Johnny, his secretary, actually said, "No, we thank you for your interest, but Mr. Carson doesn't have time now." I also have that letter because Bill saved everything. Somehow through Doc Severinsen's publicist, Bill was allowed to go backstage for one of the early April shows of 1992, sort of glean color, watch Carson walk in and out of the makeup thing, you know, watch from the wings, talk to people who were there. So that was his sort of entree into Johnny world. And after Johnny retired in 1992, Bill would stop by the offices in Santa Monica. Johnny had retirement offices. They do clip licensing. It was on Main Street in Santa Monica. And he would get to know Johnny's inner circle and his executive assistant and other folks in the office, Johnny's nephew, Jeff Sotsing. And little by little, he became a familiar figure. And as he's becoming a familiar figure, he's also writing more about David Letterman, and he's writing about Jay Leno. He's becoming this chronicler of late night, and I'm sure Johnny took note of that too. So finally, when Johnny retires, it has been 10 years, Bill again approaches him and says, "Well, I'd love to document you sort of in repose as you're, you know, relaxing here," because Johnny didn't come back. When he was gone, he was gone, and nobody had scored an interview with him in those 10 years. And finally he said, "Okay, come on in." They had a long lunch, and Johnny opened all the doors. And so doing that was easier than doing the book because it had boundaries. This was Johnny in retirement. That was the conceit of the piece. But that is really what introduced Bill in a big way to Johnny and really what opened the doors for what ultimately became the book.
You know, as our listeners out there, there's some of a certain age who remember Carson. For younger listeners, it's can be challenging to describe that, but I lived through it, and I'm old enough to have been a Johnny Carson fan. I remember watching him every night. My parents watched him every night at 10:30 after the news. Every night, Monday through Friday. And I got to where I was watching him. What accounted for that? My focus was always on the 70s. That's what I think back of the heyday. But it was the 80s as well and the late 60s. But what was so fantastic or alluring about Johnny Carson's personality that gave him such, 30 years he hosted the show?
He did. I think Johnny, and he knew this from the beginning. He even said it on the record. My goal is to do sort of a laid back, kind of easy breezy show. He knew it was a cool medium, and Johnny himself was a cool figure. He didn't burn too hot. Whereas his predecessor, Jack Parr, was a very emotional guy. I mean, famously walked off one time because they censored one of his jokes about a water closet. I mean, of all things, but that was back in the 60s. But Johnny was a cool cat. He also brought his audience into the show. He would make them part of the show by, he didn't love to bomb, but when he did bomb, he would wink at them knowingly or nod knowingly. He also said something interesting too, is that he thought his sort of superpower, he didn't put it this way, was empathy. with the audience. He could really, really read them and had this sort of relationship with them that few hosts have. He was never talking at them. He was with them. He was one of them. And of course, he's the last face they see before they go to bed at night. And so how can that, you know, not make an impression on millions and millions of people? And as you said, it was this huge communal experience because there was free networks and it wasn't a proliferation of cable stations. It wasn't fractured like it is now. So he was kind of the perfect guy at the perfect time in the perfect medium.
In his heyday, I was amazed to read this in the book. And this is great research that you and Bill put together. But his show accounted for almost 20% of NBC's pre-tax profits. I mean, Wow, that's a lot for one show to account. And it's a sign of the popularity of the show.
It was. And I think that was in 1980, something like that. So, you know, it only grew as the 80s went on. But yeah, he was a cash cow. They wanted to keep him. That's why they always made him happy come contract time. Hey, you want 3 months off? Sure. You want to do a 60-minute show? They, you know, cut it from an hour 45 to 90 to 60. And you can argue what that did to, you know, the tone of the show, but he had to work less and less as he made more and more money.
Yeah. The book, of course, goes through, it's interesting how it's written, and I'm not going to divulge too much. I encourage people to go buy the book. It's a great, great read. But it hops around a little bit, but, Carson, of course, started, in the 60s in New York. And why did the show move from New York to Los Angeles back during that period? Was that just commercial reasons, or were there other things behind it?
Yeah, I think so. It was easier to get big guests in LA. You know, a lot of TV and movie stars, out there. He didn't leave kicking and screaming, but he didn't necessarily want to leave New York. He loved New York. Yeah, the show was in New York and of New York, truly. I think, you know, it was Fred DeCordova and Peter LaSalle, his, you know, producers who kind of nudged him out west. And, you know, I mean, they were right to do it. His profile skyrocketed when he got out there. If he was the prince of late night in New York, he became the king of late night in Los Angeles starting in 1972, you know, and it was less of a theatrical production too. New York was a pretty small studio. The Burbank studios held 465 people. So it's kind of barn-like. You could fit a lot more people in there. It was a different response to what he was doing. It was less of a theatrical response than he had in New York. But you could argue that it was definitely a huge advantage for the show.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is Mike Thomas, who was part of the creation of a great book that I encourage our listeners to get called Carson the Magnificent. I was thinking of another topic that I'll get to, the great Carsoni.
Oh, sure.
But, yeah. Mike worked with the late Bill Zamy, a great author in his own right, on this book, and put it together under interesting circumstances. We've talked about that. We've talked a little bit about Carson's Iowa roots and that how that affected his personality. I want to get into some other things that listeners that are familiar with Carson may not be aware of that was news to me. And one that I just kind of referred to, the great Carsoni, was Carson's fascination with magic, which I wasn't aware of. I mean, I remember him doing some things, one of the characters on his show, who was that? It escapes me now, when he wore the turban and all that.
Karnak. You're talking about Karnak, Karnak the Magnificent, sure.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
the title comes from, yeah.
Yeah. The interesting how magic played into this. Was that part of his sense of timing and sense of, you know, speaking, all that, or?
Yeah, timing, speaking, I heard somebody else talk about this too, a current performer, the name escapes me, but, you know, magic, especially as a kid, is really an entree for a lot of performers. You're not only, you know, doing these, you know, amazing feats of, you know, sleight of hand in front of largely adults who are amazed. It's kind of a way of having some sort of power over adults, strangely enough, when you're a kid. Like, how did you do that? I can't tell you how I did that. But of course, you're getting in front of people. It's a sense of timing. It's also a way to hide in plain sight, in a way. I mean, you know, throughout his 30 years, Johnny was this huge public figure, but he never revealed much of himself, even when he's out there in front of 17 million people at night. And so he always had that magician's sense, even on stage at The Tonight Show.
I didn't know he was in the military either. And you wrote about the sense of timing, I guess, involved with his military experience.
Yeah, that was interesting. He was on, was it the USS Pennsylvania, I believe. And he arrived on the ship on the, I want to say the 12th of August, 1945, 2 days before the Japanese surrendered. But several days prior to that, the ship had been hit by what was really the last Japanese torpedo, major torpedo incident. And so there was a lot of damage. As Johnny described it, it nearly blew the stern off. It killed, as he recounted, 20 men. And when the ship docked shortly after he got on it, he was charged with helping to go down and extract those bodies from below. And they had been there for days and days already. And he didn't talk much about that at all. Someone pulled it out of him in 1967 from Time Magazine. He was very reluctant to talk about it, but it was a horrible instance. But yeah, fortunately, he didn't have to go through much more war because it was over by the time he got on the ship.
Yeah, as a lot of good biographies do, the relationship with his parents is written about quite a bit, especially his mother. Can you kind of describe that and perhaps what impact that may have had on his personality?
Yeah, she was, you know, a very mannered woman, a very outgoing, talkative, opinionated woman, and he could never please her. He annoyed her with his magic tricks as a kid, even as he became uber famous, arguably the most famous guy in America and one of the most famous in the world. She never seemed to be impressed. At some point, though, after he died, they discovered in one of his closets in his Point Doom mansion, a scrapbook that Ruth Carson had kept of a lot of clippings of Johnny starting in the 1960s, stuff people would send her that had writing on it. You know, we love seeing your son succeed and stuff like that. And so, you know, in a way she was proud of him, but she could never really tell him that. And as a result, he never really had a close relationship with his mom. Adored his dad, but his dad was much quieter. And his dad never talked to the press, really. His mom would talk to the press all the time and tell them whatever she thought, you know, about Johnny and otherwise. His dad was very reticent.
We'll have some fun now, maybe talk about some elements of the show. Again, things that I learned, but I was surprised. The person that composed the Tonight Show theme, a name that, again, a lot of older people will remember, maybe not some younger ones.
Yeah, Paul Anka, right?
Paul Anka. Yeah.
Paul made a lot of money on that thing. I mean, he ended up splitting the money down the middle with Johnny. I think they got about $900,000 each per year for 30 years. And Paul didn't have to do much because it was actually a repurposed tune from something he wrote for Annette Funicello in 1960 called Toot Sweet. So he kind of he tweaked that up for the Tonight Show. Johnny felt like he needed to contribute something, so he contributed an initial drum intro, which got shorter as the years went on. And that's how the Tonight Show theme was born. But yeah, I mean, I would love to make all of that passive income, almost $30 million for doing next to nothing.
Wow. And then the Tonight Show theme, and then what's called, this was interesting too, the number one catchphrase soundbite in broadcast history.
Yeah, here's Johnny.
Here's Johnny.
Yeah, he just needed something a little more, you know, exciting to bring Johnny out to the audience. That was Ed's creation.
Ed McMahon, and, you know, yeah.
Ed McMahon's creation, of course, one of the most iconic parts of The Tonight Show is kind of he, Doc Severinsen, and the band leader, and Johnny were the triumvirate at The Tonight Show.
Yeah,
and you could argue that Ed was every bit as integral, but there, it's funny. There are times you watch various shows. He could also get on Johnny's nerves.
Yeah.
Either missed cues or stepping on a joke or, you know, but all in all, I mean, he was really the king of all foils. And I remember Zamy actually doing a piece on sidekicks for Esquire years ago. And Ed was one of his, of course, primary sources. It's sort of like, how do you do this? Andy Richter is also part of it. Charles Grodin is also part of it. Regis Philbin is in that article. But yeah, Ed was on the Mount Rushmore of sidekicks. Ed McMahon is the guy.
Yeah, the book goes into kind of their they had somewhat of a complicated relationship with a quote that you and Bill mentioned from McMahon regarding Johnny, that Johnny packs a tight suitcase.
Only brings with him what he needs. Yes. Yeah. He's a man of efficiency. And he's never going to emote more than necessary. He's never going to bring more with him psychically or physically or whatever it is than necessary. Yeah, so that was kind of what he was getting at there. And I guess Johnny mostly agreed with that. I'm trying to think. I think that was in a Nora Ephron piece in the late 60s. She did a great serialized behind the scenes of the Tonight Show series. So, yeah, that was for that.
And then the famous part that I remember that's mentioned in the book as well, at the end of the monologue, after here's Johnny, Johnny comes out, the band's playing, and then he gives his monologue. And then he announces the guests coming up for the night, and then he does the famous golf swing. Again, for our listeners, you can go back and look, or those who aren't aware of the Carson, the Tonight Show, but where did that come from, the famous golf swing?
It was, you know, I mean, it was just something he did and kept doing. You know, they can go back and read the book. I mean, Dick Carson talks about it. It was just, I think it was just spontaneous, and it became iconic. In fact, on the back of the book, he's doing a golf swing. He's in a tuxedo, so I'm pretty sure that's a shot from one of his Oscar hosting duties. In the late 70s and early 80s. But yeah, Johnny was more of a tennis player than a golfer too. So it was, you know, but swinging a tennis racket, I don't know, would have had the same.
yeah.
Same feel, same look. It would have been a little odd.
Yeah, and as a golfer, I saw some reference to a type of club he had called a niblick, which that was news to me, but I thought that was interesting as well.
I do remember that. That was that was in a little bit he did with Dean Martin, who was an avid golfer.
So that I thought the interesting part too at the end there when he's making all this money for NBC, but he didn't really end his career on very good terms with NBC, especially as regarding his success.
Yeah, I mean, he got the feeling they wanted him out and Jay Leno in as soon as possible. Jay had been, you know, the permanent guest host toward the end there. You know, Johnny, I think, felt a little unwanted. There are different accounts. You know, he told some of his writers that nobody asked him who he wanted to succeed him. Another person inside NBC said Johnny didn't want anything to do with the whole succession thing. I mean, you know, he never had anything against Jay, as far as I can tell. You know, he thought he was a nice guy. But Dave Letterman always was Johnny's protege. It was like a father-son relationship. And I think there was maybe an assumption that Dave would take over. And of course, Dave was not happy when everything went down, you know, with Jay Leno. And he ultimately took the slot. But Dave did quite all right over at CBS.
Yes, indeed. There was a whole book written about that succession. So that's
it's amazing. This is Bill Carter's book. Yeah, The Late Shift.
Yeah.
That is the book to read. That's the Bible of those late night wars. And it's funny today, you know, people talk about it's the opposite of what it was, because all those guys are friends now. They all hang out together. Fallon, Colbert, Kimmel, John Oliver. They did a podcast together, for God's sake. I mean, they're like, And I think Howard Stern mentioned this. He's like, you guys are too friendly. You need to bring back some of that rivalry. And they're like, meh, it's just how it is.
Yeah, there really wasn't much competition for Carson back then either.
There wasn't. Popular. People tried. People tried. Dick Cavett tried, failed.
Yep.
Joey Bishop didn't make much headway at all. But yeah, Johnny had the lion's share of the market for many, many years. And again, it was a measure of the time that he was doing this. You know, there wasn't Fracture and there wasn't a lot out there, but he had a good show and people watched it.
And the one similarity to now is you still have people back then would say, did you hear Carson last night? Did you hear what Carson said? If somebody missed, we'd always talk about that and share that. But I guess I got time for one more question here, Mike. A couple minutes, give you plenty of time. But I mean, this book, it was on the bestseller list. It was on the New York Times list. What accounts for Carson's enduring a popularity? I mean, when I saw this, when I first read about this, I thought, I got to get this book. And it just something just attracted me to it. And it's hard to explain. How could you explain that? Why it's still, people of a certain generation still feel like the strong attachment to him?
They do. I think it's an emotional attachment to him because, you know, not to repeat myself, but he's the last guy everybody saw at the end of the day. And then it was a communal experience talking about him the day after. Everything wasn't asynchronous like it is now. There was no DVR. So everybody watched the same thing at the same time and then talked about it at the same time, literally at the water cooler. I mean, that's become a cliche now, but you know, there were water coolers back then.
Actual water coolers.
Yes, of course. So that's part of it, the shared experience and just the, you know, he gave people this sense of comfort at the end of the day. And Bill speaks to that. You saw Johnny. He was not only a soft out to the day because he was never too controversial. He was easy breezy. Nothing was too in your face. He wasn't overtly political. And so it was a nice way to go to sleep, actually. He didn't put people to sleep, but he eased their minds at the end of the day. And I think people are very appreciative, especially of funny people who can take your mind off whatever is happening in the world. That's why you see so much outpouring when comedians die, because it's magic to make people laugh. And that's what Carson did night after night.
And he laughed at himself. And I think that's something that, we need a little more too. Like I say, this book brought back a lot of warm memories and it's just a feeling of comfort, I guess, like home, he elicits, from that period again. And this was during some tumultuous times in our country's history, the 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s.
It was. He went through all kinds of tumult during his tenure, starting with, 62? That would have been like the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Going back then? All the way through, you know, the Iraq War and the 70s and Nixon and Vietnam. But Johnny was always somewhat removed from that. He might make little remarks, but he never focused on it. His show was easy breezy escapism.
Mike Thomas has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. He's worked with the late Bill Zamy on an excellent book I strongly recommend called Carson, the Magnificent, about Johnny Carson. Again, I think listeners, you'll love it if you get it. And Mike, again, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Thanks, Robin. It was great being with you.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.